Unveiling the secrets A-list copywriters use to make themselves and their clients millions. This is the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel. For the listeners that haven't been keeping track, this is episode 365. If you started listening at episode one today, you'd have a full year's worth of content before you caught up to where we're at. That's exciting, man.
I know. It's a real milestone.
It is. And because it's such a milestone, I checked out the notes. You've got a great show lined up for us, so I want to just jump right into it.
Okie dokie. Well, let's do it. So we've talked about stories a lot. I've written a book about stories, The Persuasion Story Code. And once you can start using stories effectively in your copy, you have, for all practical purposes, developed a marketing superpower. But don't stop there, because the difference between a story and a strong story can be the difference between high-test gasoline and rocket fuel. One will get you there faster, but one will get you there a lot faster and go a lot further. Strong stories are the rocket fuel in your sales copy. And we're going to talk about five ways to make any story stronger today. But first, we need to review the second greatest story ever told. It's a true story and worth reviewing. Copy is powerful. You're responsible for how you use what you hear in this podcast. Most of the time, common sense is all you need. But if you make extreme claims, and if you're writing copy for offers in highly regulated industries like health, finance, business opportunity, you may want to get a legal review after you write and before you start using your copy. My larger clients do this all the time, and they lived happily ever after. Okay, so let's get into the five ways. We got a lot to cover, so without any further ado, let's do it. Okay. The first one is to use word pictures all the way through your copy. It's pretty clear to me that, except for accountants who think in numbers, and that's important around this time of year in the U.S., but I digress. I'll start over. It's pretty clear to me the overwhelming majority of people who are not accountants think in stories and pictures, not in facts and figures. Add to that, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. And I think it's also true that a series of pictures or images sequenced in the right way is not only worth thousands of words, but millions of dollars. Because a story with the artful placement of word pictures, that is words that call up images in your mind, that kind of story will reach your prospect deeper than anything else. And see, getting a prospect to experience your product in advance may be the single best way to increase your sales. Thus, that's where the millions of dollars comes from, if you can scale. Now, let's bring in a new topic. And if you're listening or watching this podcast, baseball season has been underway for just over 3 weeks in the USA. And really, which team couldn't use a better pitcher? So I've imagined a method to train pitchers that, of course, in my imagination, is simply better than any other method out there. I'll call it, wait for it, the strike zone method. Let me give you two stories for this imaginary training product. The first story is without word pictures. I didn't use AI to write it, but I could have. The strike zone method gives you unparalleled accuracy and control. Batters will hold you in high esteem, but have little affinity for you. Your pitching style will be consistent and fruitful, and any variation you encounter will not detract from your objectives. When strikeouts occur, this will not only be a predictable result that favors your team and keeps the other team at bay. Your team will appreciate the power of your pitches. Okay. Standard issue, assembly line copy. Not horrible, but not all that great either. Now, let's compare what you just heard to this story with picture words. The strike zone method gives you the power to throw the ball exactly where you want it every time. Batters will look at you with fear when you are on the mound. As you wind up and deliver a speeding fastball that crosses the plate with precision and confidence, you'll never be surprised by the swing and a miss that puts frowns of frustration on the batter's face. Nor will you find it unusual that all your teammates are cheering for you, clapping their hands and stomping the ground with their feet. Notice in that second story, well, did you see anything in your mind? Did you feel anything in your body? Are you ready to buy the strike zone method for your favorite pitcher? Does anyone know a Cracker Jack pitching coach who can create the product? Well, that's the power of putting word pictures in your stories.
The first example was very exposition. It was very much just telling, telling, telling. The second one, the second example, put me in the seats, put me there, and I was watching it happen. And that's two completely different feelings. And one is so much more immersive. And if you really want to pull people into your copy, the second approach is what does it.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. It does. One is kind of objective and detached, and the other one is interactive, immersive, like you say. Yeah, that's great.
I'm also picking up a pattern. Maybe the emu commercials are being written by AI?
I wouldn't be surprised.
All right, let's continue.
Okay. The second way to make any story stronger is keep it simple. Very simple. So when you simplify a story as much as you can, you've got a more powerful story. Sometimes to get to a very short story, you have to start out by writing a long story and then boiling it down. And that's why they say, and I quote, writing is rewriting. But now let's take a look at two 4-sentence paragraphs from two famous American authors, Ernest Hemingway and William Faulkner. Both were great writers, but one was much better at keeping his writing simple than the other one. And many people are saying that's why they named an app after him, the Hemingway app. Now, while this information has not been independently confirmed by copywriters, podcast fact checkers, it does make a good point, doesn't it? Okay, let's get to the two stories. Or they're really micro stories themselves. First one is a 4-sentence paragraph from Hemingway pulled from his book, A Farewell to Arms. Outside it was getting light. I walked down the empty street to the cafe. There was a light in the window. I went in and stood at the Zig bar, and an old man served me a glass of white wine and a brioche. This 4-sentence paragraph, by the way, has a readability index that says a second grader can understand it. Now, here's a 4-sentence paragraph from Faulkner from his short story, Dry September. She was 38 or 39. She lived in a small frame house with her invalid mother and a thin, sallow, unflagging aunt, where each morning between 10 and 11, she would appear on the porch in a lace-trimmed boudoir cap to sit swinging in the porch until noon. That's 2 sentences. After dinner, she lay down for a while until the afternoon began to cool. Then, in one of the 3 or 4 new voile dresses which she had each summer, she would go downtown to spend the afternoon in the stores with the other ladies, where they would handle the goods and haggle over the prices in cold, immediate voices, without any intention of buying. Faulkner, readability score 12th grade.
As you're reading those, by the time you get to the end of a sentence, I've already forgotten the point you were trying to make at the beginning.
I know. Well, it's different style, you know. Bigger words and longer sentences in Faulkner's, of course. And the biggest difference, which speaks to what you're saying, Nathan, is the last Hemingway sentence was 23 words. The last Faulkner sentence was more than twice as long as 51 words. So the rules for simple are pretty simple themselves. Short words, short sentences, short paragraphs, but mix it up so it's not monotonous, doesn't sound like a machine gun in slow motion, right? One idea per sentence and a paragraph covers no more than it absolutely needs to.
Also, I think this goes to credibility. I don't know. Any parent out there listening right now knows that when their kid is lying, they just go on and keep trying to make this. They keep adding to the story and adding to the story. And you're like, okay, you're obviously lying. When you're telling the truth, it's just, hey, me and Jimmy were down by the thing and this thing happened and we don't know exactly what, but that's what happened. But if it's me and Jimmy were down there and then the spaceship came and then the aliens told us to do it, but then we told them no, but then they were like, we're going to come and kidnap. The more embellished the story gets, the longer the sentences get, the longer the story gets, the more opportunity for the reader, the prospect, to start being like, I don't know if this is completely believable. So it matters a lot in copywriting.
It definitely does. I mean, if you can get an agent to represent you, you can get an editor to accept it, and you get a publisher to pay you. You can go anywhere you want, but I think simpler is better. But everyone's got their own preferred style for sure, right? Okay, so the third way to make any story stronger is use familiar words, ideas, and situations. Now, you've got to watch out for buzzwords that are familiar to you, but may sound like a word from a foreign language to your prospect. So if you're in the corporate world and you're writing to people outside your bubble, don't say Wiley was unemployed after Acme Corporation right-sized. Only corporate jargon speakers will know what you meant was Wiley was unemployed after Acme Corporation let some of its workers go. Another problem that makes stories unfamiliar comes when you use big words people might know, but they have to spend too much mental effort to decode the word in order to understand what you're saying. So don't say, Mr. Acme promulgated the company's mission. It's a perfectly good use of the word promulgate or promulgate. I'm not sure how to say it because I don't use it that often. But it would be difficult for your average reader or listener to quickly grasp the meaning of what you're saying. So much better to say, Mr. Acme shared the company's mission statement with its employees. Now that we have seen what unfamiliar language looks like, let's see what familiar language looks like. And I would say you can open just about any real mega best-selling novel, Stephen King or James Patterson, or Greg Hurwitz with The Orphan X. I particularly like Jack Reacher, and here's the opening to his novel, The Midnight Line, first paragraph of the novel. Now, there's only one word in here I think that's not familiar, although it's probably familiar to Copywriters Podcast subscribers since the word is a writing word. But anyway, let's listen to how ordinary the language is and how brilliantly it's put together. Jack Reacher and Michelle Chang spent 3 days in Milwaukee. On the fourth morning, she was gone. Reacher came back to the room with coffee and found a note on his pillow. He had seen such notes before. They all said the same thing, either directly or indirectly. Chang's note was indirect and more elegant than most. It was a ballpoint scrawl on motel newspaper gone wavy with damp, but elegant in terms of expression. She had used a simile to explain and flatter and apologize all at once. She had written, "You're like New York City. I'd love to visit, but I could never live there." Wow. The only possible problem word is simile. I did a readability check, and the whole paragraph is at the fourth grade level. So this strategy of keeping everything familiar in a story is especially important if you have a technical product and you tend to use a lot of industry jargon. People in your niche will understand the jargon, but if you use too much of it, it will slow down your story and dilute the effect.
Okay, you've brought up the concept that your copy should be like a greased chute or a greased slide. Every time there's one of those words that they have to stop and think, what does that mean? Or even worse, open up a new tab and go to dictionary.com. You've lost them. That slide ride has come to a stop. The one thing that I wanted to add about this, though, is you were talking about industry jargon. One rule that I kind of have, it's a fast and loose rule, but it's still kind of a rule. The more awareness level the target market has, the more I can get away with industry jargon. But if they're at the very beginning of the awareness cycle, I try to stay away from industry jargon as much as possible. So it's kind of like there's not a one size fits all rule for it. It depends on where the reader is at.
Yeah, that's a great distinction. I never thought of that, but it seems like it would be absolutely true. Appreciate that. Okay, let's do number four. Make your story as relatable as possible. Hollywood knows how to do this better than anyone else, and that is make a story relatable. We may never learn to do it as well as they do, but we can learn from them. So let's start by looking at what Hollywood routinely does, both in movies and on TV shows. Did you ever notice how in some of the most esoteric and far-flung plots, even in sci-fi, there are anchors of family, nostalgia for a past we can all relate to, or something about a non-family relationship that reaches across the divisions in our world to make a story something we can identify with, no matter how different the characters and situations are from the ones we're familiar with in our own lives? Steven Spielberg is a master storyteller in many ways. Listen to this description from his old movie, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. So in the first 8 minutes of the movie, we see a spaceship full of aliens who have four fingers on each hand. They're not very relatable. But then starting in the ninth minute, the aliens fade out and we're in the kitchen of a Southern California suburban home. 5 10-year-old boys are using dominoes and painted characters to play Dungeons and Dragons on the kitchen table, which is also covered with soft drink bottles and empty potato chip bags, just like you would see at the time in any number of suburban kitchen tables across America. And this was 1982, before video games had taken over. That image, that action is easy to relate to. Kitchen, suburban home, dominoes, soft drinks, potato chips, 10-year-old boys playing a game. These are all very relatable. So here are some tips for creating relatable characters in any story. Relatable characters are determined to reach their goals and keep trying in the face of frustration. They care deeply about their own families. They take responsibility for themselves and solve their own problems. They're authentic in what they say and how they react to situations. And they persevere in spite of their own doubts and fears. When you're putting together a persuasion story of any kind, as simple as it may be, see if you can show a bit of the flawed humanity of your characters and show their admirable qualities too. Show these things not through adjectives or descriptions, but by what your characters say and what they do. Stories about ordinary people in ordinary situations with ordinary problems who discover unusually good solutions to those problems make for great persuasion stories.
Okay, I just purchased the baseball pitching offer that you mentioned earlier in the show, so I'm going to throw a curveball at you real quick.
Whoa!
you mentioned sci-fi stories, and I know that being a huge fan of sci-fi, culture plays into it. American sci-fi stories very often have, Western culture sci-fi stories very often have like a Wild West feel to them. The bandits outrunning the sheriff in the great wide open. And that's not as true in sci-fi that comes from like Asia or other areas that also have a lot of prolific sci-fi writers. So culture and familiarity, knowing where your target market is from and the culture that they're part of, and having that culture also be kind of subtly woven in. I wanted to get your thoughts on that because I had never even thought about it until just right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's taking what I'm talking about and just chunking up, moving it, you know, one step wider and deeper. Absolutely. I mean, that is the whole point of familiarity, is to take what's essentially known and comfortable and familiar and then add one rogue element that is so bizarre that it's interesting. But, you know, if the culture was not human, if it was some invented space culture, and, you know, people write stuff like that, it doesn't work very well. Mm-hmm. There's just too many mental hurdles you have to get over at once to really enjoy it.
I think the little bit of familiarity helps keep you tied to it while they introduce the new thing. And in copywriting and marketing, a lot of times we're introducing something revolutionary, wild, new. And if we don't have that familiarity to tie it to, we lose them right away. So it makes sense.
Yeah, and that's a mistake a lot of people make. You know, a lot of very creative, inventive, forward-thinking people come up with something new, and then they think everything has to be new. They have to invent new buzzwords. They have to invent new paradigms. They have to invent, and so it just becomes too much. I mean, you know, we'll go back to a classic example. I mean, the iPod was so revolutionary, but Steve Jobs brilliantly said, 1,000 songs in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know what a song is. I know what my pocket is. I know that, you know, on a, what do we have? What was that Sony thing? Walkman, you couldn't get 1,000 songs in it, right? So the one difference really, because you could, if you had a big enough pocket, you could get a Walkman in it, right? Maybe a jacket pocket. But the difference is, instead of the number of songs that could fit on a cassette, 1,000. And that was all it took, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brilliant.
All right, let's do number five. Do your research to increase believability. Let's say you were going to make a film about hostage negotiation. Not talking about the situation in Israel and Gaza. I mean, like, just good old domestic, old-fashioned hostages in the U.S. How would you prepare for it? Would you read a few articles on the subject? Maybe interview a real-life hostage negotiator? So when screenwriters James DeMonaco and Kevin Fox were writing the script for the movie The Negotiator, they studied minute-by-minute accounts of 200 real-life negotiations. And one of the stars of the movie, Samuel L. Jackson, joined the Los Angeles Police Department golf tournament before filming began on the golf course Jackson partnered with and interviewed a former FBI hostage negotiator for a few hours while they were walking around the golf course. In Chicago, where the movie was being made, Jackson's co-star Kevin Spacey reached out to an experienced local police hostage negotiation team to find out about the emotional terrain of hostage negotiations. And the film's production company hired a business that was staffed with ex-cops to ask questions as they came up about how actual negotiations tend to unfold. Plus, they also got actual diagrams, plans, and instruction manuals for how hostage phones and other devices work. Now, that's a lot of research. Why did they do it? To get every behavioral and technical detail for making the story as realistic and thus as believable as possible. Because stories need to be believed to be accepted. Mm-hmm. In the last chapter, we took a good, believable, no, scratch that. But how do you get a story to be believable in the first place? Well, to take a page out of the preparation for negotiator research, don't simply use your imagination to make something up that might not bear any resemblance to reality. Find out first through research. And there are three kinds of research that are really helpful with believability. The first one is factual research, and this is what most people think about when you say research. Of course, this includes researching the product or service you intend to sell to learn the features and the benefits. But factual research also encompasses learning how people actually use the product or benefit from the service in their everyday lives. Seeking out that information can lead to some very good persuasion stories. A second kind of research is emotional research. If the product or service you're selling solves a problem, find out how people feel about the problem. Online, you can look at Reddit and other forums. You can look at reviews on Amazon and what do they call it? Yelp's good. It turns out people aren't shy about complaining. Complaints offer valuable information about how people feel, and Amazon comments for other products solve the same problem as yours can also be a gold mine. And if you're working Trustpilot is what I was thinking of. Mm. Yeah, Trustpilot. And if you're working with a larger business that has other salespeople or customer service reps, talk to those people. situational research. And this is a little less directly related than the first two kinds of research, but it's just as important. What's going on in the world around you? Prospects and customers live in that same world. For example, if you're working in an industry that fears new waves of government regulation coming on soon, it's important for you to know that and to work it into your story if it fits. All of this research is for the same end result. As a prospect hears or reads your story, you would like to get one or both of the following reactions from them, even if the reaction is only thought but not spoken. This reaction, yeah, that really could have happened. Or, yes, that's exactly what it's like. When you put what other people already perceive as real and true into your stories, it just makes them all that much more powerful.
Two things come to mind. Number one, how skeptical most people are nowadays, especially with all the scams that they've already been burnt with. They're just looking for hints of a red flag, and that extra research will pay off in helping avoid that situation. The other thing is, gosh, I think it's a Bible quote, something like, agree with thine adversary quickly. If you're trying to convince somebody or persuade somebody of something, the best thing to do is start with the overlap of your worldviews and then move from there. If you can't start with the overlap, you're never going to get on the same page. So doing that extra research to know where they're at, to know what they believe, to know how they feel, to know all of those things that when they're reading it, they're going to keep saying, yes, that's exactly how I've been through that. I know how that feels. If you can do that, then when you get to the end where you say, hey, this is the solution that I found, there's going to be a lot more trust built up and a lot more likely that they're going to take your advice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as we get more polarized and tribalized, you know, one of the first questions that comes up that might not have been as prominent in the past, one of the first questions that comes up in a prospect's mind is he one of us? Is she one of us or not? You know, and this will at least create the illusion that you're one of them.
Listen, it's not my tribe that's polarized. It's your tribe that's polarized.
That's right. That's right.
All right. You want to jump into a recap real quick before we're out of here?
Yeah. Number one, use word pictures all the way through. Number two, keep it simple. Very simple. Be Hemingway. Don't be Faulkner. Number three, use familiar words, ideas, and situations. Four, make your story as relatable as possible. And five, do your research to increase believability. Mm-hmm. And, oh, by the way, if you'd like to know how to write these stories, I've got a book for you. It's called The Persuasion Story Code. It's on Amazon. We'll put a link in the show notes, and it'll help you write these stories that you can make very, very powerful.
Absolutely. So if you want to check out more episodes, like I said, 365 episodes so far, you want a year's worth of content, head on over to copywriterspodcast.com. While you're there, check out the show notes for this particular episode. There'll be a link straight to David's new book in the show notes for this episode. And until next time, we will catch you later.
Catch you later.
Before we go, a quick question. Would you like to have me as a guest on your podcast? Let me give you an easy way to contact me about that. We've put up a form on garfinkelmedia.com, and it won't take much more than a minute to fill it out. So if you'd like to have me on your show, just go to garfinkelmedia.com and fill out the form. That's garfinkelmedia.com. Thanks, and see you next time on the Copywriters Podcast.
This is the Copy and Funnels Podcast Network.